Okay, here we are back. You're listening to KOWS 107.3 FM. It's the What Now Show, Mondays from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. That was Oliver Nelson with Eric Dolphy. And on the line from the beautiful state of Virginia is Saba Malik.
Hello.
Hello, Saba.
How are you, Ken?
I'm well, thank you so much.
What's the weather like in Occidental there?
Sorry?
What's the weather like in Occidental?
Well, it's been uniformly gray and chilly and drizzly for about 10 days now. So it's more of the same. We get a little splash of sunshine here and there, but it's been pretty cold and damp. But we don't complain in Sonoma County.
No. It's pretty cold out here.
Yeah, I would think it is. You had a big storm. Were you there for the storm?
Yeah, we got here just before the storm happened, and so we got to see lots of feet of snow. But then it was followed by a rainstorm, so now most of the snow has disappeared,
yeah.
And it's just very cold.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you have a roof over your head and good company, so...
Yes, I do. I'm
not,
very
not
privileged
so bad.
And blessed in that way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm particularly pleased to have you on the show because it's a great relief to be talking to someone who's not a university professor or has a book out.
Thank you.
So you're highly qualified.
Well, thank you very much for asking me to be on the show.
Yes. My sense is that we're gonna talk culture and politics. Is that about right?
Yeah.
Good, good. Would you do us the favor of introducing yourself to whatever degree you feel comfortable?
Sure. Well, my name is Saba Malik. I was born in England, the daughter of immigrant parents from the Indian subcontinent, and I moved to the USA about 8 years ago, actually 2 weeks before the bombing of the Twin Towers, 24th of August, 2001.
Welcome to the USA,
California, because I got married and my husband was a US citizen, so we moved here. And in 2002, I heard a speech by Michael Rupert on Guns and Butter on KPFA about peak oil. And that changed my world. From that point on, I decided that I needed to do as much investigation into this phenomena as possible. And that brought about what I call my own great education. I was fairly politicized before, but I had no idea really about the ecological and environmental impact of the way that modern industrial culture lives and what we're doing to the planet and what we're doing to everything on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of the education also became... I started to become more active in my local community. I do a fair amount of community work in my local school, in my children's school. I have two children. And I do, activist work in San Francisco around feminist, like kind of porn culture, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's about all I can say about myself. I don't have any, as you say, I don't have any, I'm not a published author. I'm just a very ordinary, everyday woman with two children who's very, very worried about where we're going.
Right.
And
right.
What's going to happen
right.
in the future.
Right. It's our great loss that we only hear, certain voices that these days, if you're, we mostly hear publicly from, as I said, men and women who are recently published and who are teaching in academia, and it's a very thin slice of the family spectrum. So I'm particularly.
I agree. It would be great to hear more, as I call myself, ordinary people talking about the reality of their lives.
Yes.
And, you know, what they're trying to do, what they're trying to accomplish, and what they see.
Yeah. I heard recently, I hadn't heard from Michael Rupert, for maybe two or three years. The last I had heard of him was that he had gone to Venezuela.
Oh, he's back.
Yes, I heard he's back. Yeah. And, I hear he was also very, very seriously ill. So
yes.
I was greatly relieved to hear that he's back and, that he's fundamentally sound. And, I actually tried to contact him to invite him on the show, but.
Yeah, I was going to say he would be a great person to interview.
Yeah, I'm a great admirer of his. He's a very courageous man, and, not going to spend too much time talking about him now. For those who are interested, From the Wilderness was his, publication. And I'm sure that can be accessed.
Oh yes, you can go to www.fromthewilderness.com and you can still get all that archives. It's still up.
And he wrote a momentous book called Crossing the Rubicon.
That's right.
Yeah.
It is amazing.
Yeah.
That's a book that everybody should read, as well as Overshoot by William Catton.
Yes, yes. So here we are in 2010, and it's promising to be an extraordinary year for all of us. So,
indeed.
Tell us what you see.
Well, what I see is not very happy. It's not a very pretty picture. I think when we take into account let's just take a few statistics. Can we do that? Can I just
Absolutely. Rattle
off a few statistics about
Please.
This culture?
Yes.
We talk about 60% of processed foods in the supermarket are genetically engineered, and they've not been proven safe. While citizens are required by law to pay income taxes, 60% of U.S. companies pay no income tax at all. Then you have things like one out of every three women are raped or sexually assaulted in their lifetimes, and that's only the reported figures. Of the top 10 richest people in the U.S., four are Walmart heirs. Their joint wealth totals, I think, $62.3 billion. Five companies control 80% of what people watch on TV, and 10 companies control two-thirds of what people hear on radio. 90% of the large fish in the ocean are gone. About a quarter of the world's coral reefs have been badly damaged or destroyed in the past several decades. The three richest people in the world have assets greater than the combined wealth of the 40 poorest countries where 600 million people live. Let's just think about that. The three richest people in the world have assets greater than the combined wealth of the 40 poorest countries where 600 million people live. 257 individuals alone accumulate more wealth than 2.8 billion persons. That's equivalent to 45% of the human population. And these are... I mean, this might be an odd way to start an interview on how we should respond to the ecological and social carnage we see in the world today, but to remind ourselves of just how horrifying these facts are, it brings to mind that facts such as these and literally hundreds of more like them, all equally horrifying, which clearly describe an insane culture. But the most insane part of it is that these facts are accepted by most of us in this culture as the way life is. I mean, I can quote those facts and people say, oh, it's terrible, isn't it? But that's the way life is. That's life.
Well, it's...
And I think it's the that's life philosophy. That's what I call it. I call it the that's life philosophy, which has played a big part in allowing the genocide of the entire world to continue.
Yes. Oh, there's no question about it. This is a collective insanity, and we're absolutely implicated in it. And it's for us to learn. It's for us to perceive what's in front of us, what we have co-created. This is the game we've been playing for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. It's
yeah.
called competition for resources, and it's much akin to the end of a long game of Monopoly, where one player has all the hotels on all the properties, and essentially it's the very end of the game, and we're looking at the end of a long period of social organization that has led to this this grotesque imbalance, to put it politely, but it's more like just a gross perversion of any sort of decent human values. So we're at the end of the road. We're at the end of the road that we have, as you say, that we have kind of by default just assumed that this is the way life is.
Yeah.
And you know as well as I that the good news is that this is not the only way to live.
And one of the problems is, and I just want to say something about collective responsibility. Well, I absolutely agree that in many ways we are collectively responsible, because we don't hold those in power accountable who are actually making the most profit from this insane venture. It's also the systems of oppression which are in place, which allow the system to continue. And, you know, those are patriarchy, capitalism, mainly. And the thing is that any other way to live, any other way to live is, I think we tend to, when we hear of Burida people who lived a more idyllic life, and I have personal experience of that, because in 1992, while I was traveling the world, I spent 3 months in a small village in the Hunza Valley, which is right up the top of Pakistan. It's on the border of Pakistan and China. And I believe it's, I can't remember the author's name, but the man who wrote Lost Horizons and based his utopia, which is Shangri-La,
mm-hmm.
on the Valley of Hunza, where it's absolutely beautiful. It's famed for the people have lived to very, very old ages. And they live a much more idyllic life, a laterally organized culture without layers of hierarchy and or riches or want. And I experienced that for 3 months. And we tend to think of those as either mythological or, if real, simply too ignorant to have developed civilization. That's one of the problems, I think. And certainly with books like The Ecological Indian, there's a worldwide movement afoot today to prove that indigenous people were every bit as rapacious and planet destructive as we are, albeit less technically competent. And I'm not arguing that, I think certainly some were, but those generalizations always fell, because there were many, many cultures who do live or have lived extremely profoundly good lives, in the sense that they've been very happy, they've lived in place, they're profoundly connected to their land base. And I was lucky enough to experience that for 3 months. And that's, I think, when a huge change happened inside me and I started to question the ways of our culture.
Right.
Because these people, they didn't have any set of laws, they didn't have prisons, they didn't have police. And they've been living like that for thousands of years.
Yeah.
And they haven't destroyed the place where they lived. It's still a paradise, as I think was the USA before,
Before Whitey showed up.
Sorry?
I said before Whitey showed up.
Yeah, before the civilized Whitey showed up, exactly.
Yeah.
We only have to read the letters and the diaries of those first few people who came, who describe it as a, you know, fecund, lush wonderland. It was absolutely beautiful, and that's the experience that I had in Hunza.
Yeah, well.
And of a people. It's interesting. I was talking about this a few months ago at a talk given by Nate Higgins. I believe he's from the Oil Drum. And I talked about being in Hunza. And one of the people, there was a couple of anthropologists there. And one of the anthropologists came to me and he said, really, they don't have any system of hierarchy? Are you sure? I've studied many cultures and they all have systems of hierarchy. But I think one of the problems is that we tend to think in terms of our own limited concept of what hierarchy means. And when you start looking at cultures, cultures are embedded in their language. And in Hunza, in all the villages, one of the constant factors in all the villages was nobody can tell anybody else what to do. That there's no such thing as telling somebody else that they have to do something, another adult. And even in lots of cases, children. And so just by that definition, leadership, for example, would mean something very, very different. Do you understand? Does that make sense?
Yes.
I mean, we tend to think of leadership and hierarchy in our own terms, but when we go and study other cultures, and it's one of the problems that I have with anthropologists is that it seems to be that they base everything on Western scientific theory and their own concepts rather than actually really studying the people that they go to meet, you know, and study.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's such a different experience. Different cultures are different cultures, and it's very we can hardly be expected to make an empathic communion with other cultures easily because their foundations are so other than what our foundations are. To be born into a particular culture is to be thoroughly and deeply acculturated in that culture, if that
Absolutely.
Doesn't sound too crazy. So I think we have to cut ourselves some slack and understand that we're facing up to this very difficult reality that's our circumstance now, and we can take a little time and beat ourselves up, and we can moon over other cultures that have done a better job perhaps than we have of living sustainably, etc., etc. But what we're obliged to do now is actually secure a future for our children, for your children and your children's children, and try to prevent our perishing here, because we're very close, we're in grave danger of losing it, of fumbling the ball.
Well, certainly humanity is in danger of going extinct. That's true. Whether the rest of the planet would suffer as a consequence of that is questionable to me. I think as far as the planet is concerned, all the other species and all the other living beings on this planet might not see the demise of humanity as an entirely bad thing. And that may be that is very controversial for most people to think about, because we are a culture that believes that we are ultimately superior to every other life form.
Well, we have been acting that way, and we have believed that, and to a large degree we still do, but I think it's a position that's weakening rapidly.
I hope so. I don't mean to, when you say, it's not really about cutting ourselves some slack, it's accepting. And this is the difficult part for most people. It's accepting, just saying, God, this was a really bad idea. The way that we set up our culture is a really bad idea. And
yes.
Even just to say that is difficult for most people. And that's why if you do use other cultures as an example of how a people manage to live sustainably, and it's not about mooning about them, it's just stating the facts that, look, there's this culture, that, you know, this is how they do things, maybe we could learn something from them. I think inherently there's this attitude that this culture is somehow superior, and so very many people find it very difficult to say, to actually just state that fact, that the way that we live is insane, and that we could learn much from other land-based indigenous cultures. It's like most people just don't want to accept that. They want to find, and that's why I say that when you bring up these cultures, they're either thought of as mythological, or then, you know, people are trying to prove that they're just as wanton and they're just as, you know, driven to destruction and destroying one another and the ecological framework as this culture has been. And in that way, I think that people need to start. I mean, the reality of it is that there are still a few cultures, there's not very many, but there were very many cultures who did know how to live in place, and they did know how to live sustainably.
Right.
And that's all I'm saying is, can we not just accept that? And then with that idea, move forward into the future.
Yes.
Because as long as we fight that, I don't think, and I think part of it is, you know, so much of the so-called green movement, whatever that means, wants to keep the framework of this culture going, as we see with the whole idea of some kind of green capitalism or natural capital. But at the same time, it's like, you know, sustainable economics, that's an oxymoron. You know, anybody who has any idea, I mean, the word sustainable is so overused. I mean, sustainable, what does it mean? There's a very easy definition. Any act that can be carried on indefinitely without materially harming the land base.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that, I mean, it's stunning to me how capitalism has become a sacred cow that no one will attack in discourse. And especially advocates of green capitalism. You know, we might sometimes hear the term global corporate economy, mentioned unfavorably, but hardly ever do people use the word for the current dominant current economic system which holds sway, which is capitalism. It's the profit. It basically, if you have, I was almost cringing to hear one prominent environmentalist who had otherwise made a great speech at a Bioneers conference some years ago state that since capitalism had so thoroughly defeated the ideals of socialism in the 20th century, and by the way, I'm not saying that socialism is the answer, but I'm just saying what he said. Since capitalism had so thoroughly defeated the ideals of socialism in the 20th century, what needed to be done was to provide a moral framework for the profit system so that it protected life rather than destroying it. Now, it sounds like a wonderful concept, except that it's not grounded in reality. The profit system, however ethical, will always hold profit at the center of its concerns and not the protection of life.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, there's a big gap between making a living and all the traffic will bear, and it is fundamentally a matter of ethics or morals or so much. I think a lot of what needs to be happening is actually beginning to really happen. It's a question of how much time we have to really kick it into a higher gear and turn this wheel just that much quicker.
So can I ask you, Ken, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but you say that you see many things happening that should be happening, like, for example, give me an example, because, I mean, I know that having been in the, I mean, I'm at the moment, I'm in Virginia, but I live in the Bay Area, in the San Francisco Bay Area, and there are many organizations, you know, doing local community work, doing the work of, you know, some restoration, permaculture, relocalization, all of these things. And I'm not saying, I think that that is wonderful work. I am involved in that work. I want to be very upfront in that. But it is, as far as real world physical, like if I had to measurements go, everything is going the wrong way. The amount of carbon dioxide in the air,
yes,
the amount of plastic in the oceans, the amount of all of those things, that even more than they were before.
Yes.
So whatever we're doing essentially at this point is not working, and we don't have very much time left.
Well, yes, that's correct. There's a momentum. I think we're witnessing the final momentum of a whole way of life that is bankrupt. And I think more and more people, if not most people, might not be able to articulate it to a fare thee well. But I think almost everyone feels it in their bones and in their cells that something very, very huge, that we're in the midst of something enormous, and that at a very bedrock level, this way of life doesn't work anymore, and that it's a monstrosity, and that it's a desecration, and that it's ruinous, and that it's fatal, and that I feel that perception and that at a feeling level, I think we all are, I think it has everyone's attention. And we're in the midst of an unprecedented, passionate, moment in our family's, history. We are seeing ourselves in the mirror almost as if it's for the first time. We're seeing how grotesque our, institutions have become, all through our own, assent and cooperation. We're horrified at the image that we see in the mirror. Go ahead.
And I think that...
And I think this is good.
Oh, yeah, no, I think it's good to be horrified. That it's a horrifying situation. But I think our response so far is fairly pathetic in
yes.
terms of effectiveness.
Yes, it continues to be inadequate.
It's completely inadequate. I mean, it's not that that work is not important. It's extremely important, but I suppose my view is unless all of this community work that so many organizations are engaging in, unless it is linked to a broader political struggle and a question of the system and questioning of the systems of oppression that allow this system to continue, then we're not going to really get anywhere. Because what we're doing, when we talk about alternative culture, that's all it is. It's an alternative culture. It's not questioning the dominant paradigm. It's not in opposition to the dominant paradigm, which is killing the planet. There's no question about it.
And I think it's a mistake to externalize the blame or the responsibility. We are the dominant paradigm. We were born into this culture, and we have interjected its values. We have been propagandized and conditioned since the minute we were born into the values of this culture, and it takes.
And I agree with you, but I think that there are perpetrators who are. I mean, I'm not.
And we're responsible for them. We're responsible.
We're responsible for not standing up to them.
Well,
but I don't think we're responsible. I mean, that I am not responsible for the damage that Union Carbide do in India.
I think one of the problems
is that we place the moral blame for these things. We place it on ourselves rather than where it belongs, which is with the extremely rich and powerful.
Well, I think we,
you know, at the end of the day, if, the three richest people in the world have assets greater than, like, 600 million people. That's something to, we need to question that. Those 600 million people living in the 40 poorest countries are not doing the damage.
Right.
I'm not meaning to be difficult, but
no, please,
I think
be
the way
difficult.
That I see it, one of the things that, and I think ethical lifestyle choices are very worthy and important. I don't wish to minimize the importance of paradigm shifts on a personal level, but at the same time, I want to be realistic and as honest as possible as to their effectiveness in slowing the destruction of the planet. In April 2008 in Science Daily, there was this article which gives some perspective, and it discusses an extensive study conducted by a class at MIT. And this class examined the impact of lifestyle choices of Americans. And the study estimated individual carbon emissions from a wide variety of lifestyles, from the homeless to the multimillionaires, from Buddhist monks, and those living in vehicles and to soccer moms. I mean, it was right down the line. And this is basically, I'm reading directly now from the report. It says, the energy impact for the rich was estimated from published sources, while all the others were based on direct interviews. The somewhat disquieting bottom line is that in the U.S., even the people with the lowest usage of energy are still producing more than double the global per capita average. The average annual carbon dioxide emissions per person, they found, was 20 metric tons, compared to a world average of 4 tons. The floor below which nobody in the U.S. can reach, no matter a person's energy choices, turned out to be 8.5 tons. That was the emissions calculated for a homeless person who ate in soup kitchens and slept in homeless shelters or on the street. So if the study is to be believed, even if every person in the U.S. were to drop out of the system, so to speak, what they would be actually doing is dropping to the lowest possible level of consumption supported by the system.
I understand what you're saying. I understand that even the least among us, by circumstance, are still it's a tremendously wasteful.
And this is another direct quote from the EIA website, the Energy Information Administration. It stated that 80% of U.S. carbon dioxide emissions come from the use of coal and industrial sectors. That's not personal. I mean, we can all be personally completely change our lifestyles.
But what I mean about
we need to be questioning and in opposition to the dominant power structure that is allowing this to continue, and that to me is industrial capitalism.
You see, I think that's what's destroying the planet. I think we need
It's industrial capitalism that invented plastic. It's now everywhere.
We invented plastic.
Yeah,
we are the dominant industrial culture. We.
Mm-hmm.
There's no them. There's just us.
Oh, I think that, but I disagree. I think there is. I didn't invent plastic.
See, because I don't think it's an oppositional. I didn't even know
what plastic was, like, properly until a few years ago, until I investigated it. Like, what is plastic? Was anybody asked? These were ventures set up by extremely rich and powerful people to make a lot of money. And then they were sold to the masses because, you know, that's the way to make money, and everybody was happy but did people understand the impact? So did they know? Were they asked? Would they have said yes?
No, very few of us understood the impact of any of this, 100 years ago or even 50 years ago. This has all, we have been in such an accelerated state of quote, growth and progress like a cancer, that we've all been shocked to find ourselves at a dead end and in big trouble in the 21st century. It's come up on all of us, on almost all of us, very suddenly, and we're scrambling like mad to get our bearings and to study and learn and make and perceive the transformations that are required of us in a very brief period of time if we're going to have any possibility of any sort of future whatsoever. And there are tens of millions of people all over the globe working day and night feverishly to get up to speed to be able to fashion a successful response to this emergency. And to me, it's more a matter of enveloping the industrial society than it is opposing it. I think the days of opposition, of us and them, I think it's a failed orientation.
I don't think it was ever tried.
Well, I think there have been oppositions to the dominant societies for hundreds of years or thousands of years. There's always been a we and them, an us and them mentality to the whole of human social life. It's never ending. It's a perpetual state of war, and we're all driven half mad by it, if not 7/8 mad by it. It's exhausting, and it doesn't seem to be productive. Ultimately, the vision of some great revolution, I don't see it happening in the way that it's been dreamed and articulated in the past. I think we're in a new world. And I think ultimately we hold all the trump cards, and that much of the flaw in why we're so frustrated and why we're so imperiled is that we have not yet successfully fashioned an adequate response to this family crisis. This is a crisis in our family, and we may not feel responsible for all the atrocities and all the perversions in our institutions and in our social organization, but what that says is that it's time that we take responsibility for every shred of human behavior, every scrap of it. If there are individuals, I mean, this system selects for sociopathic behavior. The political system and the economic system selects for pathological behavior. So now we have all these psychopaths and sociopaths in positions of great wealth and great power. And if we don't take responsibility for all of that in our own understanding, in the way we approach our family business, we need to take care of business. This is our family. And again, we have all the trump cards because...
I guess I don't agree. I don't see those people as my family.
Well, they are. Like it or not, they are. These are your brothers and sisters.
I don't think they see me as their family either.
Well, we are.
The only family they understand is money and profit.
They're our family. They're our brothers and sisters.
I mean, it could be said that they don't even care about their own families. I mean, these people have children.
They probably don't. They're probably very ill. They're very sick people, and they're our brothers and sisters, like it or not.
Yeah, I have to disagree with that. But that, you know, we'll have to agree to disagree on that. I think that there hasn't been, when I look at the struggles of people such as the Zapatistas, if you want to talk about something that inspires me, it's movements like the Zapatista movement.
Mm-hmm.
It's movements like MEND, the movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta, who told the oil industry, you either leave our country or you're going to die in it. And they have caused such incredible damage to the infrastructure of the oil industry, and they're knee-deep in toxic sludge. So maybe that's what it takes. You know, maybe we'll have to be knee-deep in toxic sludge before we, you know, start any kind of real political resistance. I think it's absolutely necessary to have political resistance, because politics and profit are absolutely hand in glove together.
Yes.
And they have been. I mean, what we live in now, I see as Mussolini's ideal world. I mean, he wanted, you know, power and politics and money and corporate to be together. That was his his definition of fascism.
I think political resistance has its place, and I think that it's our obligation to refashion it or reimagine a form of political resistance that's much more wise than the paradigms of the past, or the paradigms of resistance and opposition in times gone by. I think things are I think we're in a different world now, and I'd like to continue this because it's, you know, we can agree to disagree, but I think it's all the more important that we continue to hack away at our disagreements and see where they lead us. Because it's not a matter of who's right. It's a matter of that collectively, you and I together and all of us, we need to get it right now. And that includes all viewpoints. All viewpoints have to be able to, show themselves in public and be able to defend themselves, and all viewpoints need to be challenged if we feel that they're flawed or,
And I would absolutely agree with you, and I really respect the fact that, you know, you want to raise different, you know, voices and perspectives coming from, you know, different people. I think that that's really wonderful, and I thank you for the opportunity for, you know, me being able to share my perspective. But I do think that this perspective is a perspective that is growing in this movement, and you know, there's more and more people who feel like I do that political resistance is an absolutely necessary part if we are going to have any future on this planet, as the human project now I'm talking about. Because the planet, essentially, I mean, we're destroying it, and it is being destroyed, but in the end it will destroy all of us if we don't shape up and do something.
No question about it. Let's continue talking about it. I mean, let's make another date.
Another date?
Yes, and pick it up a little further down the line.
Okay.
All right?
You're on, Ken.
Good. I greatly appreciate you coming on, and I particularly appreciate that that you are a voice of the common man and woman, as am I, and as ultimately we all are, because there are none among us who are not common. When you strip off a lot of the affectations and a lot of the cultural costumes.
Oh, absolutely. We all have to shit, sleep, eat, and die.
That's right.
You know, that's the bottom line.
That's right. And we're all brothers and sisters, whether you like it or not.
Okay. I shan't disagree, but I do.
Okay. We'll speak again?
Yes, definitely.
Thanks.
Thank you, Ken.
Be well. Happy New Year.
All right, and you.
That's Saba Malik. I hope, I don't know if I'm pronouncing Malik, or I think it's Malik. Saba Malik, talking to us from Virginia, and I very much appreciate it. She is clearly an intelligent woman with a mother of two, and caring and alarmed and thoughtful and intent on, as all of us are, I feel obliged to be, intent on seeing if we can pull our behinds out of the fire, see if we can not go down the drain right now. That ultimately, I think there's every reason to be loyal to our species. As much as it may be a great relief to all the other hundreds of millions or billions of other species, because good Lord, we're a bad neighbor, and we've been a horror to this earth and to its inhabitants and to ourselves. And gee, we're trying like crazy to wake up, and we either will or we won't in time. Remains to be seen. Anyway, I'd like to get back with Ms. Malik another time down the road. We'll book another another talk with her. I think it's a real, I feel a great sense of relief to just be talking to Saba. So, we're going to take a little musical break and we'll be back in a couple of minutes with Aaron Wood.